The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. We're reading today from the combined January-February 2019 edition of Smithsonian, Fighting to be American. For centuries, immigrants who served in the military could become American citizens, but are the women and men pictured here among the last? By Christy M. Klock, K-L-O-K, and on the opposite page, a portrait, photograph of Army Reservist Zhao Meng Sun, who left China 6 years ago, believes that military training teaches one to meet challenges. On a sweltering summer morning in downtown Los Angeles, more than 8,000 men, women, and children made their way to the L.A. Convention Center, with street vendors hawking an array of citizenship-related merchandise, including fast-selling embossed covers for naturalization certificates, parking lot attendants whistling and waving towels to woo motorists and groups tailgating with breakfast burritos and iced coffees. The festive atmosphere felt more like the run-up to a football game than a legal proceeding. Among the thousands of people who would take part in that day's two successive swearing-in ceremonies and become naturalized U.S. citizens were 25 who had already made a big commitment to the nation as service members, individuals who had taken an oath to protect the rights of U.S. citizens, even though they themselves did not have those rights. The United States has a long history of immigrants serving in the military, from the Revolutionary War on. While military service has never been a guarantee of citizenship, it has often led to it. Immigrants made up nearly one-fifth of America's armed forces during World War I. Today, an estimated 20,000 non-citizen immigrants serve in the U.S. military. Many of the service members at the Los Angeles ceremony acknowledged that the promise of citizenship contributed to their decision to enlist. To join the military, an immigrant must possess a permanent resident card or green card, live in the United States, and hold a high school diploma or GED. But there are other reasons as well. Marine Corporal Kevin Alvarez, a native of Colombia, said that international events are what finally motivated him to sign up. I started seeing what was going on with refugees. There were Syrians trying to get across a body of water to Greece, and they ended up drowning. It really resonated with me, and I decided I wanted to be in the Marine Corps. I wanted to help. Army National Guard PFC Jesus Colazo, who was born in Mexico, said that his lifelong goal was to be in the U.S. military, and that potential citizenship played no role in his decision to volunteer. After graduating from high school in Fontana, California, where he'd lived since he was 5, he tried to enlist in the Army, but was told he couldn't because he was not a legal permanent resident. "That's when I found out I wasn't a U.S. citizen," says Colazo. "It was a slap in the face. I didn't know I wasn't a citizen until I was 17. He gained lawful residency 10 years later when he married a woman who was a U.S. citizen. He joined the Army 3 weeks later. It wasn't until decades after serving in the Marines during the Vietnam War that Nick Warren, who had immigrated from Greece as a boy, even considered becoming a citizen. Citizenship never crossed my mind. My life was fine. What was the point? But when Warren, a truck driver, discovered the federal government had imposed stricter requirements in 2017 to maintain his commercial Class A driver's license, he began the citizenship application process. I wanted to keep my job. That was my motivation. As the thousands of people representing 128 countries filed into the convention center for the two ceremonies, the military members, most in uniform, were escorted to seats in the front row. Many were surprised by the preferential treatment. Marine Corporal Bong Cho, a native of South Korea, appreciated the gesture, but played down the event itself. I don't really consider this to be a big day. When I swore in as a Marine, that was a big day. That changed my life forever. For if any Chiku Okoro, a specialist in the Army Reserve who grew up in Nigeria, the day brought an overwhelming sense of relief. He is part of a special program, Military Accessions Vital to the National Interest, MAVNI, authorized in 2008 during the George W. Bush administration. The initiative recruited immigrants with valuable foreign language or medical skills by offering expedited citizenship in return for military service. But the Obama administration introduced additional requirements in late 2016, and the Trump administration announced in late 2017 that the program had been suspended. MAVNI participants who filed for citizenship before they remained eligible, but their status is often unclear. Some have been discharged. Unlike many immigrants serving in the military, MAVNI recruits have no green card prerequisite. Okoro said the program's discontinuation left him in limbo, with no defined immigration status to fall back on if his citizenship was denied. The uncertainty lasted nearly a year before his application was approved. I feel like I can start my life again. It's been really tough. To say that it's been stressful would be an understatement. And it's not just me. There are thousands of MAVNI going through this. Now my stress will be having to see them go through it too. Changing immigration policies also created difficulties for Army Reserve PFC Chow Meng Sun during her 2.5-year application process. When her father died in China in 2016, she didn't attend his funeral there, because she feared the new immigration restrictions would prohibit her from reentering the United States, regardless of her military status. I was devastated, she said. The Trump administration has attempted to impose additional hurdles for lawful permanent residents, green card holders, who want to serve in the military. Those efforts have thus far been blocked by the courts. Once Federal Judge Martin Barash administered the Oath of Allegiance and spoke about their new responsibilities and privileges, he singled out each service member by name, the only new citizens offered this recognition, and the crowd responded with standing ovations. For Okoro, this show of appreciation was particularly heartwarming, given the unusual circumstances for immigrants in the military. Until that moment, he admitted, it bothered me that I served my country, but I didn't have all the rights of citizens. As the ceremony concluded, the military members were asked to stand again, and Judge Barash came down from the stage and spoke with each one privately, while the thousands in the hall sat patiently for almost 15 minutes. Now citizens, the service members were the first to leave, marching out to more applause. Warren, who had insisted that he was becoming a citizen only to keep his truck driving job, appeared quite emotional, pursing his lips and squinting as he stared forward intently. I didn't expect to be moved like that, he said, holding his naturalization certificate. I couldn't believe the applause we got. The whole thing, it was really special. Next, The Legacy of Black Hawk Down, by Michael Byers. 25 years after the disastrous battle chronicled in the best-selling book, the author argues that we've learned the wrong lessons about fighting terrorists overseas. 25 years ago, I was drawn to Somalia in the aftermath of Operation Restore Hope, a U.S. initiative supporting a United States resolution that aimed to halt widespread starvation. The effort, started in 1992, secured trade routes so food could get to Somalis. The UN estimated that no fewer than 250,000 lives were saved. But Operation Restore Hope would be best remembered in the United States for a spectacular debacle that has shaped foreign policy ever since. Almost right away, militias led by the Somali warlord Mohamed Farah Adid began attacking and killing UN peacekeepers. On October 3 and 4, 1993, U.S. forces set out on a snatch-and-grab mission to arrest two of Adeed's lieutenants. The plan was to surround a white three-story house in the capital city of Mogadishu, where leaders of Adeed's Habar Gidar clan were gathering. Rangers would helicopter in, lower themselves on ropes, and surround the building on all sides. A ground convoy of trucks and Humvees would wait outside the gate to carry away the troops and their prisoners. Altogether, the operation would involve 19 aircraft, 12 vehicles, and around 160 troops. The operation didn't go as planned. The ground convoy ran up against barricades formed by local militias. One helicopter landed a block north of its target and couldn't move closer because of ground fire. A ranger fell from his rope and had to be evacuated. Insurgents shot down two American Black Hawk helicopters with rocket-propelled grenades. When about 90 U.S. Rangers and Delta Force operators rushed to the rescue, they were caught in an intense exchange of gunfire and trapped overnight. Altogether, the 18-hour urban firefight, later known as the Battle of Mogadishu, left 18 Americans and hundreds of Somalis dead. News outlets broadcast searing images of jubilant mobs dragging the bodies of dead Army special operators and helicopter crewmen through the streets of Mogadishu. The newly elected U.S. President, Bill Clinton, halted the mission and ordered the special forces out by March 31, 1994. For Somalis, the consequences were severe. Civil war raged. Adeed himself was killed in the fighting in 1996, and the country remained lawless for decades. Pirate gangs along the country's long Indian Ocean coastline menaced vital shipping lanes. Wealthy and educated Somalis fled. When I visited Somalia for the first time in 1997, the country was well off the map of world interest. There were no commercial flights to the capital city, but each morning small planes took off from Wilson Airport in Nairobi, Kenya, for rural landing strips throughout the country. My plane was met by a small platoon of hired gunmen. On our way into the city, smaller bands or brigands grudgingly removed barriers that had been stretched across the dirt road to halt traffic. The driver of my vehicle tossed fistfuls of near-worthless paper Somalia shillings as we passed these local versions of toll booths. The city itself was in ruins. The few large buildings were battle-scarred and filled with squatters, whose fires glowed through windows empty of glass and stripped of aluminum frames. Gas generators banged away to provide power to those few places where people could afford it. Militias fought along the borders of city sectors, filling the hospitals with bloody fighters, most of them teenagers. The streets were mostly empty, except for caravans of gunmen. Without government, laws, schools, trash pickups, or any feature of civil society, extended clans offered the only semblance of safety or order. Most were at war with each other for scarce resources. I described this wasteland in my 1999 book about the Battle of Mogadishu and its aftermath, Black Hawk Down, the basis of the 2001 movie directed by Ridley Scott. When I returned to the States and spoke to college audiences about the state of things in Somalia, I would ask if there were any anarchists in the crowd. Usually a hand or two went up. "Good news," I told them, "you won't have to wait. The consequences we felt in America, too." After Mogadishu, the United States became wary of deploying ground troops anywhere. So there was no help from America in 1994, when Rwandan Hutus slaughtered as many as a million of their Tutsi countrymen. Despite a global outcry, U.S. forces stayed home in 1995 as Bosnian Serbs mounted a genocidal campaign against Muslim and Croatian civilians. The isolationism ended abruptly on September 11, 2001. But even as Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama sent troops to Iraq and Afghanistan, they kept their distance from the Islamic insurgents in Somalia. During the last 2 years of the Obama administration, there were only 18 airstrikes, both drones and manned, on Somalia. Now things are changing. In the past 2 years, U.S. forces have conducted 63 airstrikes on targets in Somalia. The number of American forces on the ground has doubled to about 500, and there have already been fatalities. A Navy SEAL, Senior Chief Special Warfare Operator Kyle Milliken, was killed in May of 2017, assisting Somalia National Army troops in a raid about 40 miles west of Mogadishu. And Army Staff Sergeant Alexander Conrad was killed and four others wounded in June of 2018 during a joint mission in Jubaland. All of this might raise the question, what do we expect to achieve by returning to Somalia? After years of turmoil in Afghanistan and Iraq, why should we expect this mission to be any different? A casual visitor to Mogadishu today might not see an urgent need for U.S. ground troops. There are tall new buildings, and most of the old shanties have been replaced by houses. There are police, sanitation crews, and new construction everywhere. Peaceful streets and thriving markets have begun to restore the city to its former glory as a seaside resort and port. Somalia expatriates have begun reinvesting, and some are returning. The airport is up and running with regular Turkish Airlines flights. Brigadier General Miguel Castellanos first entered Mogadishu as a young army officer with the 10th Mountain Division in 1992. Looking down from the open door of a Black Hawk helicopter, he is now the senior U.S. military officer in Somalia. I was pretty surprised when I landed a year ago and there was actually a skyline, he told me. Somalia largely has its neighbors to thank for this prosperity. In 2007, African Union soldiers, mostly from Uganda, but also from Kenya, Ethiopia, Burundi, Djibouti, and Sierra Leone, began pushing the extremist group, the Shabab, out of the country's urban centers with an effort dubbed the African Union Mission to Somalia, AMISOM for short. The United States led support in the form of training and equipment. Turkey and the United Arab Emirates have taken advantage of the newfound peace and bankroll development of Somalia's port cities. The problem is in the rural areas. There, basic security depends almost entirely on local militias, whose loyalties are tied to clans and warlords. There's a real black-and-white, good-and-evil struggle in Somalia, said Stephen Schwartz, who served as U.S. ambassador there until the end of September 2017. The forces of chaos, of Islamist extremism, are powerful and have decades of inertia behind them in criminality, the warlords and cartels. If current conditions persist, the Shabab, al-Qaeda's affiliate in East Africa, could end up controlling large parts of the country, says Abdullah Halaki, a security consultant for the Horn of Africa, who previously worked for the UN and the BBC. They would be running their own schools, their own clinics, collecting trash. That is where the appeal of this group comes. So far, the United States has been dealing with this threat with a string of targeted killings. Top Shabab leaders were killed by U.S. raids and airstrikes in 2017 and 2018. But the experts I spoke with told me these hits may not ultimately accomplish much. Killing leaders is fine, makes everybody feel good. They wake up in the morning, big headlines, they can quantify. Oh, we killed this guy, we killed that guy. But it has absolutely no long-term effect, and it really doesn't have any short-term effect either, said Brigadier General Don Bulldog, who, until last year, commanded special operations in Africa and directly oversaw such efforts. Someone is always going to be there to be the next leader. Every expert I spoke with recommended investing in rebuilding the country instead. This approach didn't work well in Afghanistan, but there are differences. Somalia's president, Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, is friendly to the United States, and he was chosen by his own people, not installed by the U.S. Somalia's Islamist extremists no longer enjoy broad ideological support. There was a time when the Shabab could transcend all the regional clan differences and project this kind of pan-Somalia, pan-Islam type of image, said Halaki. That is gone. The country's problems are mostly economic, says Bolduc, and solving them would cost so much less than the trillions spent in Afghanistan and Iraq that the question doesn't fall into the same category. He points to success in Puntland, Somalia's northernmost member state. In 2017, Bolduc and his special forces worked with the state's president, Abdulwali Mohammed Al-Ghass, with American diplomats to assemble local forces and tribal elders. They trained the Puntland militias, but offered no air or ground support. Working entirely on their own, Somali forces moved from southern Puntland up to a northern port where the Islamic State, a rival of the Shabab, had established control. They took back everything and secured it in about a week. ISIS East Africa has not been able to get a foothold back into these areas, says Bolduc, and those villages are holding today. Schwartz says this success could be replicated throughout Somalia if the United States invested a fraction of what it has been spending on special operators and drones. The budget of the Somali government is comparable to the salary cap for the Washington Nationals baseball team, he said. They're both around $210 million. He said that less than half that amount would be enough to enable the president to pay the salaries of Somalia National Army recruits and other government employees. That step alone, he says, would make our investment on the military side more successful. It would be foolish to try such an intervention in other countries where America's in conflicts. It wouldn't work, for example, in Pakistan, where there's a powerful Islamist presence, a sophisticated military, and a history of tensions with the United States. Our experiences in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and years ago in Vietnam showed us that American effort will continually fail if there isn't a willing local government with the support of the people. But just because those approaches failed in the past doesn't mean they have to fail in Somalia. Radical Islam takes different forms, and there can be no one-size-fits-all approach to fighting it. In countries where leaders are friendly and ideologies don't run deep, there may still be an opportunity to build enduring stability. These days, that might be as good a definition of victory as we can get. Lastly today, here's an essay, Military Intelligence. In a new Smithsonian poll, troops and veterans take aim at conventional wisdom by Terrence Monmeny. It's no secret that many Americans are fatigued by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now it's clear for the first time that the troops are too, according to a new poll conducted by Smithsonian with two partners, the Defense Department publication Stars and Stripes and the SCAR School at George Mason University. 17 years after the U.S.-led military invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, more than 80% of 1,031 service members and veterans surveyed agreed with the statement that the occupations have been going on too long. As far as we know, this survey was the first one to pose that question to current and former service members. Their frustration is significant because they also voiced strong support for the war on terror generally, with 83% saying it should continue. On the home front, 65% of respondents backed the move by President Trump to deploy armed forces at the U.S. border with Mexico to prevent illegal immigration. At the same time, the great majority appeared to take a dim view of the administration's proposal to deport non-citizen service members or their families. The military community was more in step with the administration's proposed policy, currently being challenged in court, to ban transgender people in the armed services. Overall, 39% of respondents said transgender people should be allowed to serve. In particular, though, female and millennial respondents were more in favor of transgender troops than the survey population as a whole, with more than 50% expressing support. Taken together, the findings suggest that military life poses special difficulties for women, despite their eagerness to serve. About two-thirds of current and former female service members said they had experienced sexual discrimination while in the military. The same proportion said they had experienced sexual harassment or assault. That level of mistreatment is twice as high as other recent studies have reported. Perhaps women subjected to such duress were more likely than other women to respond to the survey invitation. As for males, only 6% reported experiencing sexual discrimination, harassment, or assault. Some answers depended on the age of the survey taker. Compared with millennials, the greatest generation was twice as supportive of sending troops to the border, half as supportive of transgender troops, far more likely to say the military prepared them for later life, and about one-seventh as likely to relax by playing first-person shooter video games, whatever that means. With about 2 minutes of time left for our reading, why not ask Smithsonian? You've got questions, we've got experts. Why are starfish shaped like stars? Bonnie Hao of Beijing, China asks. Scientists can't pinpoint exactly why starfish evolved to have radial symmetry with arms, usually 5, but as many as 40 in some species, growing from a central axis. However, Dave Pawson, emeritus senior scientist at the National Museum of Natural History, notes that the arrangement confers certain advantages on the animals, which, lacking a backbone, aren't technically fish. At the tip of each arm is an eye that can detect changes in light intensity, and on the bottom are tube feet that enable it to move in any direction. Several species of starfish can regenerate an arm lost to a predator or an accident, and a few can even regenerate a new central disc from a severed arm as long as a fragment of the disc remains with the arm. Why were teachers' colleges called normal schools? Asks Lisa Frank of Los Angeles. Thank France. The phrase is derived from École Normale, which was used for institutions designed to instill standards of pedagogy and curriculum in teachers-to-be, says Debbie Schaefer-Jacobs, associate curator in the Division of Cultural and Community Life at the National Museum of American History. By the 1930s, however, most normal schools were calling themselves teachers' colleges. And there's our cue to wrap things up for this week. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And Happy New Year!